Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Congressional Power and Reimposition of Copyright Protection Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 5, 2011, Supreme Court heard the oral argument in Golan v. Holder. The question in this case is whether Congress has the power to restore copyright protection to works that have entered the public domain. To discuss the case, we have Christopher Newman, who is an assistant professor of law at the George Mason University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Newman.
Hi, this is Chris Newman. I'm an assistant professor of law at George Mason University Law School in Arlington, Virginia, where I teach copyright and civil procedure. Golan v. Holder, which was argued before the Supreme Court on October 5th, is a case challenging the constitutionality of Section 514 of the Uruguay Round Agreements Act. Section 514 is controversial because it extended U.S. copyright protection to certain classes of works that, prior to the Act, had been in the public domain in the U.S. The classes of works for which this was done consist of works by foreign authors that fell into the public domain in the U.S. for one of three reasons. Number one, the work was first published in a country which at the time did not have copyright relations with the U.S. Two, the work was a sound recording created before 1972, when Congress first extended U.S. copyright to sound recordings. Or three, the foreign author failed to comply with U.S. statutory formalities, such as affixing a proper copyright notice at the time of publication or filing a timely renewal application, failures which, at the time, had the effect of thrusting the work into the public domain. Section 514 provides copyright protection to any work by a foreign author that falls into one of these categories, provided that the work is still under copyright in its country of origin, and provided that country is a member of the Berne Convention. The Berne Convention is the leading international copyright treaty, and it requires each member country to give foreign copyright holders the same protections afforded to its own nationals. In addition to this reciprocity requirement, the convention also establishes a required minimum level of copyright protection in member countries, part of which is that copyright protection should not be forfeit due to failure to comply with formalities. The convention also contains a provision, Article 18, which requires members to restore copyright to certain foreign works whose protection would otherwise be forfeited. Now, the United States did not sign on to the Berne Convention until 1988, and at that time, Congress took what might be called a minimalist approach to passing implementing legislation. In the Berne Convention Implementation Act of 1988, Congress relieved foreign authors prospectively of the need to comply with copyright formalities, but it did not extend copyright protection to any works already in the public domain at that time. In 1994, as part of the Uruguay round of multilateral trade negotiations, the U.S. entered into another treaty, the WTO Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights, otherwise known as TRIPS. One of the TRIPS provisions, in turn, requires the treaty parties to comply with Article 18 of the Berne Convention. So, Section 514 was enacted by Congress in 1994 as a way of bringing the U.S. into compliance with TRIPS by finally bringing it into compliance with Article 18 of the Berne Convention. The result was that millions of works, which had up to that point been in the public domain in this country, were suddenly subject to copyright, which means that people who had invested resources and effort and reliance on their presumed right to make use of these works suddenly had the rug pulled out from under them. The lead petitioner, Lawrence Golan, for example, is an orchestra conductor who had built a business around performing, recording, and teaching works by Prokofiev, Stravinsky, and Shostakovich that were understood by all to be in the public domain at the time he began using them. The Act does make some effort to ameliorate the burden to people in Mr. Golan's position. It terms them reliance parties and gives them certain limited rights. So, for example, Mr. Golan cannot be held liable for any uses of the work he made before the copyright was restored, and he can continue using the works until such time as their owners file a notice of intent to enforce the restored copyright. If that occurs, he will also get a one-year grace period in which to sell any remaining copies of his acclaimed recording of Shostakovich's string quartets, and he'll be allowed to continue using any derivative works he created while the works were in the public domain. After that, however, he will no longer be able to perform, record, or distribute these works without permission, and he will have to pay royalties on any of his derivative works that he continues to use, even though he created them with the expectation that this would not be the case. So Mr. Golan and the other similarly situated petitioners challenge the constitutionality of Section 514 on two fronts. First, they argue that it exceeds the power granted to Congress under the Copyright Clause, and second, they argue that it violates the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment. Let's take the Copyright Clause argument first. This clause, in pertinent part, gives Congress the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors the exclusive right to their writings. Now, the meaning of this limited times restriction was litigated in the Supreme Court back in 2002 in Eldred v. Ashcroft, which was a challenge to the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. The petitioners in that case argued that once Congress grants a definite term of protection to a work, the limited times restriction has to prevent Congress from extending that term retroactively. Otherwise, the limited times restriction would become an unenforceable dead letter. Now, the court rejected that argument in Eldred, holding that extended terms, albeit extended, are still limited and therefore do not violate the clause on its face. In so holding, the court placed great weight on the fact that starting very early on, Congress had extended copyright terms on numerous occasions and had always given existing copyrights the benefit of the extension as well. Now, the Golan petitioners are seeking to distinguish Eldred on this point. They argue that while Congress, yes, has extended copyrights that were still in force, it has never before now restored copyright to works after they had completely fallen into the public domain. Furthermore, petitioners argue if the limited times restriction is to have any enforceable meaning at all, surely it has to mean at least that once a work's designated limited time has been allowed to expire without further extension, the public is entitled thereafter to assume and rely on an irrevocable entitlement to use the work freely. Based on the briefs and argument, it looks to me like petitioners face two primary hurdles in getting the court to accept this argument. One of them has to do with how you construe the effect of Section 514, and the other to do with how one construes the effect of the Copyright Act of 1790. At argument, Justice Ginsburg insisted repeatedly that Section 514 does not restore copyright to works that enjoyed a limited term which then expired, but only permits works that were denied their limited term to enjoy whatever would now be left of that term had there been no technicality preventing copyright from attaching in the first place. Now, it's not clear how Justice Ginsburg squares this interpretation with the fact that at least some of the restored works are ones that did have an initial term but fell into the public domain for failure to file for renewal, but nevertheless, she was quite insistent on this point. Another hurdle is the historical question of what happened in 1790 when Congress passed the first federal Copyright Act. At oral argument, Justice Sotomayor maintained vociferously that the 1790 Act had the effect of taking works out of the public domain and placing them under copyright, which would defeat petitioners' argument that this is unprecedented. The petitioners argue that this is an incorrect reading of the history, that in fact most works in 1790 were already protected by some form of common law or statutory copyright at the state level, and all the federal government did was to replace state protection with federal protection, thus guaranteeing a more uniform and reliable means for the public to know when works would fall into the public domain. This is a tricky argument because the exact status of copyright as a common law matter in the early colonies, or even in England for that matter, has been a source of dispute going back to Wheaton v. Peters, and it will be interesting to see whether the court decides ultimately to frame the issues in this case in such a way that requires them to wade into and opine on this historical question. Let's turn now to the First Amendment argument. In Eldred, the court rejected the petitioner's invitation to apply heightened scrutiny under the First Amendment to the Term Extension Act, holding that since copyright has built-in doctrines such as fair use and the idea expression distinction that serve to keep copyright from preventing the free flow of ideas, as long as copyright laws stay within the quote-unquote traditional contours of copyright protection, they don't call for heightened scrutiny under the First Amendment. In Golan, the Tenth Circuit held that removing a work from the public domain is beyond the traditional contours of copyright protection, and therefore it was appropriate to apply heightened scrutiny. Now, there was little discussion of this pointed argument, but Justice Roberts did express sympathy for the free speech interests at stake here, and Justice Kennedy stated flatly at one point that the government cannot avoid application of First Amendment scrutiny just because this is a copyright statute. There doesn't seem to be a fairly good chance that the court will actually reach the First Amendment issue and engage in some form of heightened scrutiny. Because Section 14 is undisputedly a viewpoint-neutral regulation of speech, the appropriate standard here would be intermediate scrutiny, so the government has to assert an important governmental interest unrelated to the suppression of free speech and show that it does not burden substantially more speech than necessary. There's two primary interests that the government asserts in this case. The first is bringing the U.S. into compliance with its treaty obligations. Now, this is a problematic argument, first because there's a complicated dispute over whether Section 514 as written is really necessary to bring us into compliance with Article 18. But even leaving that aside, on a more fundamental level, once you say that compliance with treaties per se counts as an important governmental interest for purposes of heightened scrutiny, it raises the concern that international law might be used as a way to circumvent domestic constitutional limits. Unsurprisingly, Justice Scalia objected to this line of reasoning and argument, saying in effect, look, either it's constitutional or it's not, but don't tell me it's constitutional because you have to do it under the treaty. In fact, the Tenth Circuit below, even though it upheld the statute under intermediate scrutiny, it declined to rely on the interest in treaty compliance as a reason for doing so. So this leaves the other main interest asserted by the government, which is that granting this sort of protection to foreign authors is necessary in order to ensure that foreign countries will grant similar protection to the works of American authors overseas. An argument Justice Breyer derided this as the idea that we should inflict harm on our consumers in the hope that foreign countries will inflict harm on theirs. Petitioners argue that in enacting the statute, Congress had no basis other than hopeful speculation for thinking that it would lead other countries to reciprocate and grant U.S. authors protections they weren't already getting. And petitioners also argue that even if they did, giving such windfalls to authors of pre-existing works at the expense of the public shouldn't count as an important interest. Respondent argues that this is just a recasting of the argument that was rejected in Eldred. In Eldred, the petitioners argued that Congress is not allowed to extend copyright protection unless it's part of a strict quid pro quo in which each new increment of protection granted is exchanged for a newly created work. As always in these arguments, much will turn on how strictly the court decides to construe the needed means and fit, and how much they're willing to defer to Congress's judgment with regard to, in this case, international relations. So as always, it would be extremely perilous to try to make any strong predictions based on what you see at argument. I think it's fair to say that Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor look strongly inclined to uphold the statute. Justice Breyer, who was the only remaining dissenter from the Eldred opinion on the court, is clearly disposed to overturn it. As for the other justices, it's difficult to say exactly where they're likely to come out, but it does look as though we are likely to see a treatment of the First Amendment and its application to copyright that may be somewhat more in depth than the one we got in the Eldred case. So that's where we are. Like you, I look forward to seeing how the opinion actually comes out. And that's all for today. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.